Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
U.S. counterterrorism officials are confirming parts of a report of a 2003 al-Qaeda plot to attack the New York City subway system with homemade cyanide bombs. According to the officials, the plot was called off by Osama bin Laden's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, just 45 days before it was supposed to be executed. Newsweek's Mark Hosenball is investigating the claims of the cyanide plot, the details of which are contained in the new book 1% Solution by reporter Ron Suskind. And Mark, Ron Suskind says American officials first learned of the plot from an al-Qaeda member. Did your sources tell you who he was or what he said?
Well, we don't really know who he was. Suskind claims that the CIA had an informant high up at the quote-unquote management level of al-Qaeda who got fed up, I guess, with the way he was being treated by other management level people, although of course we know that al-Qaeda doesn't really quite work that way. And this person who was given the code name, or at least Suskind says he was given the code name of Ali, fed information to U.S. intelligence between, I think it was late 2002 and early 2005, so for a period of a couple years there, from inside al-Qaeda, and that this guy allegedly tipped the U.S. off to this cyanide subway bombing plot.
Can you tell us briefly about the plot? It was a sort of a makeshift design that U.S. officials tried out, and it did work. What was it?
Well, according to Suskind, and this bit of the story, several U.S. officials confirmed to me, the al-Qaeda had figured out how to make an improvised cyanide bomb-type thingy, which they could put in a closed space and kill a bunch of people with. They found the plans for this thingy, which they call the Mub Tucker, on a computer that they seized from some al-Qaeda lair somewhere. The CIA took the plans for the Mub Tucker and constructed one or more of these things to see if they worked, and they did work. So it was a sort of scary thing. On the other hand, it was a pretty primitive device, as I understand it, kind of like whatever the Japanese cult used when they attacked the Tokyo subway with the sarin gas. So, you know, the idea that this would have completely blown away New York City, even if it was used, is a little bit exaggerated.
Yeah.
It would have caused tremendous disruption. It probably would have killed, maybe would have killed a whole bunch of people, but nothing like September 11th, and people would have gotten over it fairly quickly, I think.
It was apparently held together with beer cans and soda bottles, and that was the suspicion. At least we're hearing reports that the reason Osama bin Laden's number two called off this plot is that it wasn't going to be big enough to be a post-9/11 attack.
The informant inside al-Qaeda told U.S. intelligence that this plot had been specifically called off by the number two leader of al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri. The U.S. intelligence doesn't really know why Zawahiri called it off, and the most popular speculation amongst the analysts inside the government, as I understand it, was that this was because he called it off because he had something even more spectacular that was about to happen. Well, I mean, clearly, if he did have something like that up his sleeve, it's still about to happen because it never did happen.
Which is unnerving, if you were to believe all of these reports. Your sources, U.S. officials, dispute something in the Suskind book, though, even though they acknowledge the plot and that the plot was called off, according to them. Suskind says that the cell that was supposed to pull off the plot is still active in the U.S. Your sources say the cell is not active in the U.S., and we're hearing other reports that the cell never got into the U.S.
That's the sort of things I'm hearing, indeed. Suskind maintains this cell still is running around loose in the United States. He said to me, because I didn't speak to him, that anybody who claims otherwise that this cell is not in the U.S. doesn't know what they're talking about, or they have the wrong sources. I did speak to sources both at the federal and the local level who are aware of the information related to this plot, and they said to me they don't regard the threat as current, and they don't believe the cell is in the United States, and indeed I have heard suggestions that maybe it never got into the United States in the first place. I also was recently speaking to somebody this morning from British Intelligence, and they were disputing rather vigorously other parts of Suskind's book, particularly the parts that talk about how the London July 7th bomber from last year tried to get into the United States to do some sort of plot and was banned. They said, to their knowledge, this guy never tried to get into the United States, and that was my understanding as well, because I covered that London bombing. And I sort of spoke to Suskind about this on Saturday, and he sort of said to me, well, you should read my book and you'll see I have all this stuff on the London bombings that nobody else knows. I kind of wonder whether nobody else knows it because maybe it's not quite right, but anyway.
Well, but given that, just one last thought, Mark Hosenball, what do you think about the cyanide plot? Do you think that that's absolutely true?
They have a fascination with cyanide. They have a fascination with these exotic weapons. The real question is, can they deploy them effectively to kill a lot of people? And that remains an open question.
Mark Hosenball of Newsweek magazine, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, now a few minutes on an emerging online labor market. Websites have sprung up that allow amateurs to log on and do some of the work normally done by highly trained professionals in fields ranging from television production to science for far less pay. Wired magazine recently dubbed the phenomenon crowdsourcing as opposed to outsourcing, and contributing editor Jeff Howe joins us with more. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good. First of all, define crowdsourcing. What does that mean?
Well, it's a simple definition. Crowdsourcing is any time a company, an institution, and any organization takes a job that was previously performed in-house by employees and outsources it in the form of an open call to the crowd. Can you perform this job? Then we'll let you do it.
And you write about several examples of crowdsourcing. I'm thinking of one, which is the photo industry. Now, traditionally, professionals would sell a photo either directly to, you know, a news source or to an agency. How are crowdsourcing websites changing that?
These sites are called microstock sites. And the traditional stock photography model was that a photographer would have some outtakes from an assignment. An agency would represent them. And then when someone didn't have the money to, say, commission a photographer for a photo shoot, they would get these pre-shot photographs. And the cost per photograph often ran from $150 to $300, even $500 or $1,000. What a microstock site did is capitalized on the phenomenon of digital photography and the explosion in amateur photographs. If you think of the number of photographs that are now being taken by people all around the world, what microstock sites do is take the best of them, upload them to a website, use really smart, intelligent search software so that the best ones are easy to find, and they're able to sell these photographs for $1 to $5 per photograph.
Unbelievable. Now, this stock photo, iStock Photo, they have about 22,000 contributors. But what does this do? I mean, you tell a story of what this does to professional photographers.
There's one great example I use in this story. Mark Carmel is a professional photographer in Los Angeles who's able to earn somewhere in the realm of $100,000 or more a year. You know, he was able to make at least half of that off his stock photos traditionally. But at one point, the National Health Museum called him interested in some of his photos. Because it was a nonprofit, he was willing to negotiate his price down to $150 per photograph, but they wound up finding the photographs they needed at iStock Photo for roughly $1 a photo instead of $150.
Right, and so he's already seen his income go down.
Absolutely. There's a great demand for photographs that are just okay. Let's call them B-level photographs. A lot of people can take that B-level photograph now. With a Canon EOS digital and a copy of Photoshop on their computer, everyone is a decent to good photographer.
Right. And the big guys are noticing this online trend of, you know, crowdsourcing. Getty Images purchased iStock.
Well, yeah, and Jonathan Klein's quote I thought was very telling.
He's Getty CEO.
That's right. He said that if something's going to cannibalize your business, better it be one of your other businesses. So it's one of those, if you can't beat them, join them.
And so Getty, which is one of the largest agencies for photographers, now owns iStock Photo. Tell us some of the other fields in which you're seeing this trend.
We see this emerging in, say, television. Increasingly, broadcast and cable want to take advantage of the explosion in amateur-created video that you see on YouTube. YouTube, which is a site for viral videos, gets 6 or 7 million visitors a day, I think.
So, okay, you've got viral videos. These are the, you know, little videos people can make on their computers?
That's right. Videos that amateurs create on their own, that people create on their own.
And you call them, they're viral because they spread like a virus throughout the internet.
That's
people
right.
Pass them on to other people. But now, broadcasters are starting to package these.
That's right. I focused on WebJunk 20, which is a show on VH1. Which has been enormously popular. And as it sounds, WebJunk 20, they take the 20 funniest of these viral videos and they put them on air.
You call these people the packagers, obviously. These are the trollers of the internet who are finding these things that have come from crowds of people and are then packaging them in more traditional media and are going to be doing it more and more, we're guessing.
I'm almost 100% confident about it. That's certainly the horse I'm backing.
In fact, you write that VH1's parent company, which is Viacom, just purchased iFilm, which is a place where people put these video clips.
iFilm is one of the larger repositories for these amateur-created videos and viral videos generally.
Right. For people who thought, oh, it's just a bunch of, you know, it's just a crowd of people putting their stuff online, they bought iFilm, Viacom did, for $49 million.
And this is one of the rules that I sort of theorized and concluded in the research for the piece. The crowd produces mostly crap. Can I say that on radio?
Sure.
I think it was rule number 5 in my story. And people are making videos, home movies, at the rate of 52 million a week. Mm-hmm. So if 90% of that is horrible, totally unwatchable, that still leaves millions of videos, you know, say a professional broadcaster might want to package or that you might want to watch on YouTube or iFilm.
I want you to mention before we take a break, a company that got its start using crowdsourcing. It's a T-shirt company called Threadless. Tell us about them.
Threadless.com got its start by a couple of 19-year-old design school dropouts who met during a T-shirt competition, an online T-shirt design competition, and decided, why don't we create one that's just ongoing and perpetual? We'll do it online. And so they built a community of mostly designers and people with an interest in graphic design who would submit a design for a T-shirt, and then the users would vote on the best one. The best one would be fabricated and then sold to this community. Well, the community quickly grew, and people were banging down the door to submit their design and hopefully win. They pay $1,500 to $2,000 for the winning T-shirt design, but they keep all the intellectual property, and at this point, they're selling 60,000 T-shirts a month, and this without any product design department, which is generally the largest overhead at a fashion house. They're paying people to design their clothes. Threadless doesn't pay, they pay very little for the, you know, most essential service they provide.
But Jeff Howe, you know, good for Threadless, you know, because they formed this company. Bad, I would think, for American workers. You just said they pay $1,500 for the design. That's as opposed to paying maybe, you know, $60,000 to $150,000 a year. I don't know how much a graphic designer at a top place might get, and plus benefits. So doesn't this trend of crowdsourcing further endanger the American worker?
I think the jury's still out on that. Let's use Threadless as an example again. Most of these designers, it's not the $2,000 they'll make. It's that their name will be established as a successful designer. This could result in more freelance income. So we don't have a strict correlation to job loss yet. I won't say that that's not a threat, but I think what crowdsourcing is really going to be about is growth.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that 45-year-old designer making, you know, $100,000 a year might be looking askance at this kid who's just doing it to get a good reputation. Jeff Howe is contributing editor for Wired Magazine. He wrote about this new phenomenon he calls crowdsourcing in the magazine. It's the practice of using the internet to reach out to a vast labor pool of amateurs to do the work that was once the purview of professionals. When we come back, we're going to see how the scientific community is using crowdsourcing to crack some of its toughest problems, and also how some of the amateur scientists would much rather do this than have a full-time job. Jeff, stay right there. We'll be back. More ahead here and now. We're back with Wired Magazine contributing editor Jeff Howe with more on crowdsourcing. This is the practice of using the internet to reach a massive labor pool to do the jobs that were once exclusively performed by in-house professionals. And Jeff, Amazon.com set up the website Mechanical Turk. Now, that allows people at home to do generally simple tasks for small fees. For example, you interviewed someone who paid a professional to make a flow chart for $2,000. Then he paid for the same chart from someone at Mechanical Turk, but he paid $5. So we're wondering, first of all, do these crowdsourcing jobs have the potential to be online sweatshops?
I think that there's that threat, but Mechanical Turk takes advantage of what we call people's spare cycles, which is a term from computer science. University of Berkeley SETI at Home. It's the program that uses your spare processing power on your computer when you go to bed at night to further the search for extraterrestrial life, basically to process signals coming down from satellites. Programs like Mechanical Turk are taking advantage of people's spare cycles.
So you're saying that in fact, instead of replacing jobs, this is added income for workers.
That's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Well, one of the areas of crowdsourcing that's generating the most buzz is in science. You write about a specific problem that got posted on a website named Innocentive, where companies who couldn't solve some problems in-house would post them, and then if people wanted to, they could take a shot at it. Colgate-Palmolive, in this case, wanted to find a way to inject fluoride into a toothpaste tube without the fluoride dispersing into the air. The problem was posted, and someone solved it.
A man, Edward Malkerik, living outside of Toronto, saw the problem, had a background in particle physics. And he said, well, that's easy. What you do is you impart a charge to the fluoride powder, the opposite charge to the toothpaste tube, and that powder will just go directly to the tube without any dispersion, which solved the problem.
I read this story, and I thought, well, that is amazing. But then I also thought, when I read further, Colgate-Palmolive, you write, has 9,000 researchers in research and development. Why couldn't they solve the problem?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and I had the exact same one. And I think Ed Malkerik may have put it best when I put the question to him. And they said, well, because they're test tube guys, and I'm not a test tube guy.
Well, we want to bring in now the president and CEO of the website that Ed Malkerik solved the problem on. It's called Innocentive, and Dr. Alpheus Bingham joins us now. You've said I can call you Alf. Who are these people? I mean, Jeff did a little profile of the fellow who solved the toothpaste tube problem, and he was a guy living in a cluttered apartment who liked science but didn't like 9-to-5 jobs. Does that sort of resonate for the other people who sign up?
We've got some who are academics, you know, who have faculty positions. We've got others who are garage inventors. We've got retirees. I hesitate to call them hobbyists because of our solved problems, over 60% have PhDs. So they're hardly hobbyists. But they may very well be solving problems outside of their specialty discipline.
And what is the success rate?
The success rate is about 30%.
Huh. And do the companies feel at all embarrassed about, you know, they have these huge research departments, they've got, you know, buckets of money. Do they feel at all embarrassed about having to come to a website to try to fix a problem?
You know, there is a little bit of a cultural issue that undoubtedly lies underneath things. But most of the time when they come to us, they recognize that they are looking for a diversity of thought. In some cases, they want a final nail in the coffin. They want to know that they have not left a stone unturned to find a solution.
Dr. Bingham, can you tick off a couple of problems that you've seen solved on your site outside of the toothpaste tube?
Yeah, someone was looking for a replacement for chemical substance, a solvent that's used to restore artworks. A young student at the University of Dallas, whose mother was an artist, said, hey, I've got an idea based on some things I'd done with my mom in her art projects. Solve that problem. Someone, a manufacturer, used a blue dye in one of its products, and the blue dye would tend to discolor over time and produce an off-colored product as it sat on the shelf, and wanted to look for a way of stabilizing that. Someone was looking for a polymer with very specific properties that would change in its binding and unbinding properties. I'm sorry, some of these things get a little technical,
right.
As you can appreciate, which is why, you know, often these become little hurdles in a big project, and the scientists who have to aggregate them all together at the end still have an enormous role to play, even if these individual bite-sized challenges get solved in a crowdsourcing kind of fashion.
How much do they make about? You know, what's the range?
10,000 to 75,000 is what's been paid out, and we've posted problems more lucrative than that.
No, but 10,000, 75,000, you know, sounds like a lot, but can you guess how much it would have cost the companies if they did them in-house?
In most cases, these are very competitive prices because they're finding an individual who had a kind of an aha experience, and when seeing the problem, was able to complete it very efficiently. As one of our consultants says, they swung only at the pitches they really believed they could hit.
We're asking Jeff Howe of Wired Magazine about, you know, some of the perhaps ethical problems that come from this, you know, the potential job loss of salaried workers if people can just do this crowdsourcing online. What do you think about that?
Well, I hope it becomes utilized. There are times when what we really want is the efficiency of getting an answer. I go back to the comment by Edison that science is, 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration? We'd like to see that 1% grow a bit. There will still be plenty of perspiration needed to bring these solutions into commercial production, and to aggregate all the different solutions that are required to produce products.
Plus, it's fun to think that people are just spending some of their spare time online trying to figure out science questions.
It can't be bad. I like the crowdsourcing article in which, you know, some scientist who just does it for almost the sheer love of science is a featured hero, if you will, in the story.
Yeah. And Jeff Howe, bringing you back in, that was your story in Wired Magazine. Did you get that sense, too, that for some people, this was a sense of accomplishment you may not be able to get from a 9-to-5 job?
Oh, I think absolutely. Like Ed Mulcahy, who solved, you know, the problem for Colgate-Palmolive, who was, from 9-to-5, having to design HVAC systems up in Barrie, Ontario, which is a perfectly respectable job for an electrical engineer, but not one that is going to bring him the same sense of satisfaction as solving a serious problem for a major manufacturer.
Jeff Howe is a contributing editor for Wired Magazine. He wrote about the crowdsourcing phenomenon in this month's issue of the magazine. To get to his crowdsourcing blog or to his article, go to our website, here-now.org. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Alpheus Bingham, president and CEO of Innocentive. It's a company that posts problems that face the scientific community. You can also find out about Innocentive at our website. Alf, thanks.
Robin, thank you.
And you, stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Today, education officials in the state of New York are considering whether to ban the use of electric shock as a tool for behavior modification in troubled children. They're looking at procedures used at the Judge Rottenberg Center in Canton, Massachusetts. That school has been controversial for a long time. Officials in Massachusetts tried and failed in the 90s to close the center. Now state lawmakers are looking at it again. Matthew Israel, the center's founder, says shocks are the best and quickest way to modify the behaviors of children who are at risk for harming themselves or others. Well, Here Now's Alan Cockle went to the center to see just how it works.
Louisa Goldberg finds her 25-year-old son Andrew putting plastic pegs into a board in the classroom at the Judge Rottenberg Center. She says her son has the mind of a 3-year-old child and the body of a grown man. He beams when he sees her, and she stands behind him, cradling his head.
Forgive me, Jim. I didn't see you now.
You can see me because you have your glasses on.
Now I can.
Now you can see me. Did you pass?
And you came today.
I came today. I came to see you.
Louisa says Andrew has a history of dangerous, aggressive behavior towards others. He's been in residential programs since he was 9, but Louisa says therapies at other schools failed to help him, and drugs turned him into a zombie. So for the past 4.5 years, he's been here wearing electrodes strapped to his skin.
It's behind here.
He's wearing one here.
Andrew wears one device around his waist and another strapped to his leg. Staff can trigger an electric shock to punish misbehavior. Louisa says the Rottenberg approach quickly gave her son a better life.
I know that I see him. He's happy. He's happy to see us. He's happy to be here. He's happy to see the staff. He's happy to get picked up by the bus, go to his house. He wears it. He doesn't try to take it off. Whereas if shoes were uncomfortable, he would kick them off.
The shocks hurt. A visitor to the center last week tried one of the devices, and on a scale of 1 to 10, where 0 is no pain and 10 is the worst ever felt, he rated it about a 6, maybe 7. The current flowed for 2 seconds, though it seemed longer. Another device used at the center is about twice as powerful. These skin shocks are different from electroconvulsive therapy for depression. These are shocks used to cause pain. Figures on the Rottenberg website show that over an 11-year period, 77 students on the devices received a total of more than 500,000 shocks. At the center today, about 2/3 of the 250 students are from New York State, and officials there are considering a near ban on the devices.
The Judge Rottenberg Center is the only facility that I know of that uses electric skin shock.
New York's Deputy Education Commissioner Rebecca Court issued a report this month which says the center allows poorly trained high school graduates to administer shocks. The report slams Rottenberg for using shocks on children who've been physically restrained. And Court says shock is being used for reasons that New York officials never intended.
We're finding over the last few years that it's no longer being limited to students who have self-injurious or very aggressive behaviors, but is being used on students of normal intelligence who, yes, have some behavior problems, but not those kind of behavior problems.
Katie Spartacchino, a 19-year-old from Cambridge, bears this out. She came to the center 4 years ago when other programs had failed to stop her from hurting herself. But she says some of the shocks she received were for more minor offenses.
Do I think it's fair or right to be shocked for swearing? To be honest, I can't say it's right. I can't say it's wrong. I really can't give you an honest way of how I feel because I grew up with my mom saying, you can say the SH word, it's okay. You know, but then girls aren't supposed to be swearing and stuff. And I don't think it's right. I don't think it's wrong.
The walls and floors in the center are a patchwork of bold purples, green, and blues. The staff are neatly dressed and mostly young. A tour includes both the restraining devices, plastic boards with leather cuffs at the corners, and the reward component of the program, video games, movies, and a store with things students can buy using points they accrue for good behavior. Matthew Israel, the founder and director of the Judge Rottenberg Center, says there's always a good reason for administering a shock, even for what might seem a minor misbehavior.
The behaviors that you treat when you're trying to get rid of major problem behaviors, you have to be able to treat the antecedents to the behaviors. That's the typical behaviors that occur before that. If someone often does a certain thing before he lunges to attack you, it's best to treat the first behavior, even though looked at in itself, it might not seem significant.
Israel stresses that his school takes some of the toughest cases and uses almost no medication. He maintains that his use of electric shocks as aversive therapy is part of a well-established scientific tradition. When asked for published studies, he provides 7 papers by authors not connected with the school. None of them describe skin shock the way Israel uses it. 2 of the papers he provides are by University of Florida psychologist Brian Iwata. Iwata studied the use of skin shock in children who were hurting themselves 20 years ago. But he says later work showed that the approach is almost never necessary.
I think if you look at the research data, what you'd find is that far and away, alternative procedures have been equally effective in decreasing severe self-injurious behavior.
What about using it to stop more minor behavioral problems?
That's probably unjustified. Not probably, it is.
The ants go marching 2 by 2, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching 2 by 2, hurrah, hurrah. The ants go marching 2 by 2, the little ones have to tie a shoe, and they all go marching down to the ground to get out of the rain.
Iwata is a consultant at the New England Center for Children in Southborough. Here, children are evaluated using functional analysis, a well-studied approach to understanding why children are exhibiting particular behaviors and then giving them alternate ways to express their needs. The absence of this approach at Rottenberg is one of the main criticisms in the New York report. NECC uses positive reinforcement with few punishments and no painful techniques. Center Director Vincent Strully says of around 1,000 patients, he's only seen 6 who couldn't be helped this way. Electric shock may work, he says, but then what?
Well, the problem is that you can stop someone from doing something by punishing them, but what are they going to do instead? And how long must you punish them to keep the behavior out?
Did you go to field day today?
Some children at Rottenberg have been on skin shock devices for nearly a decade. Louisa Goldberg believes her son Andrew might need the devices for the rest of his life. Several parents of children at Rottenberg were interviewed for this story. All were clearly caring people who believe the center is the best choice for their children. Matthew Israel predicts that any attempt to ban the treatment will end up in court.
That report from Here Now's Alan Cockle. Well, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's herenow.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town. You're listening to Here Now. I haven't suddenly lost my manners. That's a dog eating his dinner. And what's on the menu? Well, dog food and a nightly dose of Prozac. In the early 1990s, veterinarians specializing in animal behavior began prescribing drugs like Prozac and Valium to treat dogs with behavioral problems. It's been over a decade, and we wondered, where are we on the drugs for dogs front? Well, joining us on the line is Dr. Nicholas Dodman, famed animal behaviorist at Tufts University and author of Dogs Behaving Badly, among many other books. Dr. Dodman, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here.
And you were one of the first veterinarians to prescribe Prozac and other psychopharmaceutical drugs to dogs. So, a few years in, how is it going? Is the thinking the same?
Oh, it's going very well, if you would be a protagonist of that approach. I remember back in the early days, it wasn't widely accepted even by my colleagues. And now it seems to be that, you know, every veterinary school is adopting this approach.
And what is Prozac used for?
Prozac, as in human psychiatry, can be used for almost anything. I mean, it can be used to treat aggression because it does even mood and help a temper. It can be used to treat fears and phobias, and it can be used to treat compulsive disorders. So the whole panacea, it's kind of the nearest thing to a silver bullet. When I say Prozac, it's Prozac and like drugs. I mean, Paxil, Zoloft, will do the same.
Well, we have a lot of questions, but before we get to them, let's just listen to a clip from one of your earliest clients. She first visited you in the mid-90s. Let's listen to her today.
Good boy. This is Guinness. Guinness is a Wheaton Terrier. He's 12 years old. He would snap at people, and it was a problem because it was so unpredictable. You know, with most people he was fine, but it was the eighth person or the tenth person that he would be aggressive to. Over time, the Prozac just took the edge off of his fear enough that he could get used to people and get to like people. Guinness is my child substitute, I'll admit that, and I felt paying the money for the drugs for me was a lot cheaper than college tuition. And when you have a problem dog, you try everything. You try what you can until you find out what works.
That was Catherine Marsh, a retired high school teacher with the famous now Guinness. But Dr. Dodman, you know, what do you say to people who say, okay, so a dog was nipping, but actually the use of these drugs, Prozac, it's not the dog's problem, it's our problem. We don't like dogs being dogs. We're just sort of anesthetizing them and stopping them from doing the things that dogs do.
There are normal dogs doing normal dog stuff that can be, you know, honed in by appropriate management. And, you know, we wouldn't dream of treating those with medicine. But there's also a lot of dogs who have, you know, what in human terms would be called dysfunctional backgrounds, who are raised improperly. Well, we just did a study, for example, on that problem that Guinness was showing, fear aggression. And it turns out that a dog from a dysfunctional early environment is something like 489 times more likely to display fear aggression than some control group that were, you know, behavior mm-hmm. problems that didn't involve fear aggression.
And certainly using a drug to help that dog is probably far better choice than perhaps putting the dog to sleep because they can't live with humans.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's very difficult to train that out of a dog. And when you think about it, if a dog is fearful and you punish him for showing fear, that doesn't seem to be, you know, right. the correct strategy.
What about the cost? They seem to be all over the board.
Oh, well, it's buyer beware, and you can buy 20 milligram of Prozac capsule for, you know, 25 cents if you shop wisely. 25 cents a piece for the generic version, I mean, per month is $7 or $8 a month. And if that saves the dog's life and saves somebody from getting bitten, I say why not?
Yeah. And one last thought. Some listeners might remember my cross-eyed Chihuahua, Mo. What we discovered with Mo is that, you know, towards the end when he had some neurological problems, he had a paradoxical reaction to, you know, the so-called doggy downers. This doesn't work for every dog.
Well, it depends on the downer, and it depends, you know, on the dog. So some medicines are known for their paradoxical effect. So drugs in the Valium family, Valium and Xanax and so on, can have a paradoxical response of causing increased anxiety or increased activity. Other drugs, relatively uncommon to see a paradoxical reaction. You know, so the worst you'll see is, like, not much effect.
Yeah. Dr. Nicholas Dodman, animal behaviorist at Tufts University, author of Dogs Behaving Badly and many other books. Dr. Dodman, thank you so much for this update on dogs and their pills.
My pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Summer begins this week, and you might be looking for some jazz to cool down or heat up those long evenings. Well, we're joined now by Here Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs, with some of his favorite new releases. And to start, James, an artist we just love, Ralph Towner, with a song that sounds heavenly.
Well, Robin, it does sound heavenly, and if that is the case, maybe it's because it was recorded at the church of a monastery high in the Austrian mountains. And also because Ralph Towner is absolutely at one with his instrument, the classical guitar. He also plays the 12-string, by the way, on this fantastic new recording for ECM, Timeline.
Well, remind us, because you say he recorded this at the Church of the Monastery. Towner played early on with another artist who now records a lot in cathedrals, and that's Paul Winter. We remember when Ralph Towner was in the Paul Winter concert. So remind people a little more about his biography.
I would say Ralph Towner is probably best known for co-founding the group Oregon in the early 1970s, so after he left the Winter Consort, mm-hmm. he and fellow consortians formed Oregon. I can tell you that he was instrumental in helping spread the joy of New Age and world music with Oregon. Now, he might not like those terms, but the way Oregon did it was always smart. They mixed folk and world music styles and jazz improvisation in a way that no other ensemble has done before or since.
In fact, we have to just remind ourselves. Let's listen to a little of Oregon.
Robin, I do want to say one more thing about Ralph Towner's music. It's accessible especially to fans of Joni Mitchell, and I would think also fans of the late English singer-songwriter Nick Drake.
Who do you think influenced Ralph Towner, though? I mean, who does he claim?
Maybe above all else, the pianist and composer Bill Evans. He's acknowledged that many times, that the first great trio of Bill Evans with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Mosher on drums moved him tremendously. In fact, the next tune that we're going to hear is the standard Come Rain or Come Shine, which the Bill Evans Trio recorded in 1959. Now listen to the sound that Ralph Towner gets from his instrument, the classical guitar. As always, I'm in awe.
That's Ralph Towner from his new CD, Timeline. James, you want to shift gears a bit, though, for your second selection.
I do. I want to introduce our listeners, Robin, to a singer who is making her recording debut at a relatively advanced age, although I'm not sure exactly what that age is. I'm going to guess late 40s, maybe 50 years old, doesn't really matter, because Catherine Russell's first CD, which is called Cat, is such an eclectic delight. Now, she doesn't have an astonishing voice, but she does have an appealing one in many ways. Whether she's singing jazz or the blues or a Patsy Cline country song, there's one of those on this new album. Right now, though, let's hear her take on a number that Louis Armstrong used to do. It's the one called Backo Town Blues. And after we listen a bit, I'm going to tell you a little interesting story about this particular song.
That's Catherine Russell singing Backo Town Blues. And the story behind the song?
Well, first of all, Robin, Backo Town refers to the New Orleans black ghetto. And Catherine Russell's father, Louis Russell, was a prominent New Orleans band leader during the 1920s and 30s. He wrote that song. And in the 1930s and 40s, Louis Russell was the musical director for Satchmo the Great himself, Louis Armstrong, Also, Catherine Russell's mother, Carlene Ray, was one of the first female jazz bassists, so the musical bloodlines are strong. And what do you say we hear one more by Catherine Russell?
I would love to. What have you got?
Something a little bit different from most of this album, which is sort of in the Cassandra Wilson, Madeline Peru territory.
Mm-hmm.
This is more traditional jazz. It's the standard ballad called Deep in a Dream, and she sings it dreamily.
My cigarette burns me. I wake with a start. My hand isn't hurt, but there's pain in my heart. Awake or asleep, every memory I'll keep. Deep in a dream of you.
A debut? Where
think
has
it
she
is.
Been?
She's been singing around New York for a long time, but... The record business certainly missed the boat on Catherine Russell. Thankfully, someone has rectified that situation.
Okay, that's Cat. And by the way, we'll, as always, have a list of James's choices. And for today's grand finale,
yes.
I know you want to take us to yet another musical place.
Well, I want to take you back to the future, an old-fashioned battle of the saxes. This is a terrific blowing session, and it features two of the best of the younger current saxophonists. We've got alto player Vincent Herring and tenor saxophonist Eric Alexander, locking horns.
Locking horns, and a lot with a long history in jazz.
Yeah, the tradition of what used to be called cutting contests goes way back to the New Orleans days. Guys on the same instrument or similar ones, in this case alto and tenor saxophones, going at it on the bandstand. Has been going strong since, well, let's think about this. The Basie Band of the late 1930s had Herschel Evans and Lester Young on tenor saxophones. And then we get into the 40s. Dexter Gordon and Wardell Gray went at it big time. However, probably the burningest saxophone tandem of all time, Gene Ammons and Sonny Stitt. And the tune that we're going to hear right now, as felicitous coincidence would have it, is the Gene Ammons-Sonny Stitt blues, Blues Up and Down. It was their signature. It's just a 12-bar blues. Vincent Herring and Eric Alexander swapping 12-bar phrases before they up the ante and trade fours.
Oh, boy.
Live in New York at a club that's fittingly enough called Smoke. Vincent Herring, alto. Eric Alexander, tenor, hitting.
Eric Alexander, Vincent Herring, swapping fours.
And thinking very fast on their feet.
Is that in like a 1, 2, 3, 4?
Yeah, 4-bar phrases.
Okay,
first they did 12s, and then they moved it up to 4s.
I knew that.
And I know you did. This is on the High Note label, by the way. The album is called The Battle.
We've been talking here now, jazz aficionado James Isaacs, some of his favorite new releases. And by the way, for our Boston listeners, we were listening to Ralph Towner. He's going to be in our area tomorrow. For more on that and for a list of the CDs and songs we've been talking about, go to our website, here-now.org. James, as always, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin. I'll see you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for